everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, a look at the history of Zionism, the rise of the Israeli lobby, and recent U.S. administrations acting as the servants of Israel. The object lesson is not to condemn either the Palestinians or Israel, but rather to ask the larger, overarching issue: is it possible to have peace in the Holy Lands? Is there room for two different cultures that have historically and at different times shared that land? Is it even conceivable that we would have parity, that the United States and other nations would treat both the Palestinians and the Israelis as equals? What do we make of the constant alignment of the United States with Israel and always against Palestinians? To help in this journey, we are going to have Allison Weyer. Allison is a journalist, an author, a civil rights and peace activist, and the president of the Council for the National Interest. She is also the founder of the organization If Americans Knew, which analyzes and reports on U.S. media coverage of Israel and Palestine. She has been presented at briefings before Congress on the U.S. and the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. She has lectured widely at numerous universities. She has lectured at Harvard, Columbia, Stanford, Yale, Berkeley, and to academies and institutions overseas. She's received a variety of awards, including the Phi Alpha Literary Society for Courageous Journalism on behalf of human rights. Her articles frequently appear on Counterpunch and Antiwar.com, Project Censored, in the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. Her most recent book is Against Our Better Judgment: How the United States Was Used to Create Israel, which is a thorough, meticulously sourced document that brings forth the story barely known about the history of U.S.-Israeli relations. Her website is ifamericansknew.org. Nice to have you with us today, Allison.
Hello, thank you for having me on your show.
After reading about some of the statistics in the numerous ways the United States financially supports Israel and the unchallenged power the Israeli lobby has on our elected officials and U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, the question that is certainly in my mind, and I would hope with most listeners, is what was the past history that brought the United States to be a functional servant and the primary military funder for Israel? Given the degree of conflict and violence in the Middle East, people are increasingly wake up to the fact that our relations with Israel are against our better interests and the interest of our closest allies. So how can a country the size of New Jersey hold so much power over our electorate? How is it that we can give $8.5 million a day to Israel, which has a better employment rate than the United States, when the United States today remains in a recession with no viable signs of economic growth, and when social programs are being cut and forcing more and more Americans into poverty? As you've calculated, per capita, Israel receives $10,000 more U.S. tax dollars than average. Now, think how this might help average American citizens. Therefore, I feel that what you have to offer and share from your thorough research into the early history of Zionism and U.S. foreign policy related to the founding of the State of Israel is important for people to know. U.S. media propaganda provides only myths regarding history, myths that serve only the national interests through the eyes of our politicians, the military, and corporations who rule them. But history tells a very different story about the rise of Zionism and the founding of Israel. So please take your time and share an in-depth discussion on the origins of Zionism at the turn of the 19th century. The average American associates Zionism with religious Judaism. However, you should explain the difference between religious Judaism and Zionism. So what were the ultimate goals of Zionism's fathers, and what were the hopes in founding a separate Zionist Nation. Please take your time. The forum is yours.
Thank you so much. I agree that's so essential to know what was going on and what has been going on. I was shocked when I did my research into the history of the U.S.-Israel relationship and how this so-called, well, it truly is a uniquely special relationship, how that was created, you know, when it started, why it occurred, because, as you've just pointed out, Israel is a tiny country. It has very few natural resources. It does not have oil, for example. So why has this occurred, in which we give massive amounts of money to Israel, and basically both parties do whatever Israel tells it to do? You know, a few exceptions here and there, but that's the clear pattern. How did that happen? Well, I started looking into this about 14 or 15 years ago, when I, for the first time, focused on the issue, became curious about it, ended up going to Gaza as a freelance reporter in early 2001, saw what was going on, and started to grow intensely interested in the whole issue of Israel-Palestine. Began to read and read about it. I would look for well-sourced, reliable books, read their information, go to their footnotes to see where that came from, order those additional books, go to those footnotes, order those additional books, etc., for the past about 14 years, and ended up writing my own book, which is very short. I wanted to make it as clear and concise as I could, but still try to get the information I had discovered out to the general public, because I realized that so many people who are very knowledgeable on this issue and on the regional history really did not know the U.S. history. What I discovered was that there has been a movement in the United States, worldwide, but I was focusing on the United States, that has been very active for over a century, called political Zionism. It's a highly ideological, political movement. It's not religious. It's a movement, it's a term, an ideology of political Zionism that most Americans around the country would not be able to define. In fact, many people, I suspect, would say, I think I've heard that term. What does it mean? And yet here it's been active in our country and very significant for, you know, as I said, for many decades, starting with the late 1800s. The idea was to create a Jewish state in Palestine. A few other places were considered, but very quickly, political Zionism meant to create a Jewish state in Palestine. In the late 1800s is when it began, and at that time Palestine was 95% non-Jewish. It was about 80% Muslim and about 15% Christian. So this was an ideology of dispossession. It began in Europe, but very quickly it was active in the United States. By, I think, the first conference of American Zionism, of American Zionists, was on July 4th in I think it was around 1898. I don't have my notes right in front of me. By 1910, there were tens of thousands of Zionists in the United States, and they included in many cases very influential people, lawyers, businessmen, people of some significance. It was already becoming a movement to which politicians were paying attention, especially in the larger eastern cities. It was already significant. What's important to be aware of, and was very clear in my research, is that for those early decades, it was a very, very small movement in terms of numbers. It did not represent even close to all Jewish Americans. In fact, it was only a small fraction of them. Most Jewish Americans were, you know, responded to the Zionist ideology with the view, we're Americans. We have no connection to some land far away as something that we would move to, that we're not part of some nation far away. We're part of the United States. And Zionism was not embraced. There were, in fact, a number of Jewish leaders and individuals who were actively anti-Zionist. But the Zionist movement was very, very committed to into their movement and fairly soon had fairly large amounts of money at their disposal. Also, quite early on, they got some very significant individuals to be part of the Zionist movement in the United States. The one that I mentioned quite a bit, but this is really just a small part of my book, but I think a significant part, was Louis Brandeis. Brandeis became a Zionist in around 1912, I believe. In 1914, he became the head of World Zionism. I had not even in my previous life even known such a thing existed. It did exist. It was in Europe, but it moved to the United States, and Louis Brandeis was the head of it for a period of time. It was headed up in Boston under Brandeis. A few years later, just, you know, unrelated, but Brandeis was then appointed to the Supreme Court by Woodrow Wilson. Now, when one becomes a member of the Supreme Court, a justice of the Supreme Court, the standard ethical practice is to resign your affiliations, board memberships, etc., because the idea is that you are to be a neutral arbiter of justice, not to have anything that would be a conflict of interest. So Brandeis did officially resign his leadership of World Zionism. However, it turns out, and this is documented in many books, he continued to lead the movement. And very secretly, his loyal lieutenants would come into his Supreme Court chambers, report to him about what they were doing, and he would give them directives to then go and carry out. This was, of course, highly unethical, which is why he kept it secret. And also, of course, some activities are more effective if you do them secretly, if people don't know that you're doing them. And I suspect that's probably the other reason why he did not do this openly. One of his loyal lieutenants, by the way, was a man named Felix Frankfurter. I'm sure many of your listeners will recognize that name. Another very respected, highly regarded Supreme Court justice was Felix Frankfurter. Now, at the time that he was reporting to Brandeis, he was not yet a Supreme Court justice himself. At that time, he was, I believe, a professor at Harvard. But this is what was going on there, and I maybe we'll get into some more of that a little bit later. But shocking as that was to me, because I have always respected Brandeis, I think many people have for very good reasons, so I was shocked to learn his connection to Zionism and this kind of secretive behavior, unethical behavior. But then I discovered even more. And let me give you my source, because this is fairly surprising information. I want people to look at where I learned it. You know, I didn't uncover this. This was from what I'm about to tell you was from a scholarly journal, the U.S., the history of U.S. Jewish, U.S. Jewish History Journal, very respected scholarly journal, and from a book called Israel in the Mind of America by a man named Peter Gross. Peter Gross was the diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. He was later at Harvard. He wrote a number of very establishment, well-regarded books, and one of them was a book called Israel in the Mind of America that was published by a mainstream publisher. In that book, he said that Brandeis had been, while he was a Supreme Court justice, had been the leader of a secret Zionist society working to push Zionism throughout the United States. The name of the society was the Parashim, which is, according to these sources, the Hebrew for Pharisees and separate. So there was the secret society that Brandeis was a member of. That was shocking to me. This isn't when he was a fraternity boy. This was, you know, when he was in a very powerful position in the United States. So I looked into what Gross's source was, and I found out that it was a scholarly journal, and I looked into the author of the article. It turned out to be an Israeli professor, Dr. Sarah Schmidt. She's a professor at a mainstream Israeli university. in her book, in her journal article, she wrote about the Parashim, that they would, quote, go around to sort of infect the population of the United States with Zionism. That's the kind of terminology that was used among Zionists themselves. There was even a secret induction ceremony in which a new member of the Parashim would promise that they would place Zionism above everything else in their life, specifically above family and above country. The membership clearly included, again, some very mainstream people, businessmen, professors, etc. The founder of it was a man named Horace Cowan, who at that time when he founded it was a professor at the University of Wisconsin. Before he moved to Wisconsin, he had been at Princeton. So he was, you know, a very significant person. Cowan himself, in fact, is considered the founder of cultural pluralism, which I found interesting because here he was advocating an ideology of really the opposite of cultural pluralism, in which one culture would dominate a country, in which a country would be founded on the whole assumption of domination of one culture, of Jewish peoplehood. It wasn't a religious identification. Nobody was asked, do you believe in God or do you follow the commandments or anything? It was just, you know, who was your mother and your grandmother kind of affiliation. So it was very strange to have Cowan pushing something that was so clearly the opposite of what he was endorsing for the United States. I don't know if shall I keep going or?
Yes, this is the type of education. Yes, Allison. Well, the American media never has the time to share anything in depth. This program, the Progressive Commentary Hour, has only one theme, no commercial interruptions, and today only one guest. And we wanted you as the single guest so that you will have uninterrupted opportunity to give us a proper history in a context that allows us then to understand how we have evolved to where we're at today. So please continue. This is the foundation. And without a foundation on anything, then you're left with vapidness. So give us the substance.
Thank you so much. I agree. So often I sort of, like everybody, have to sort of give short little soundbite types of things, which I'm not good at anyway, and it's so nice to have the time to go into things a bit more thoroughly. Well, to get back to Brandeis, so now we've learned through these very strong sources, if people get my book, they will see it's over half citations. So everything that I see in there is cited, and people can look at the source and evaluate it for themselves. So all of that, of course, again, was truly astounding to me. I did not expect to find this kind of information, but I did, and I think people need to know it. And then I found even more about Brandeis and about the Parashim and their significance to Americans and to the founding of Israel. I found in another article by Peter Gross, and again, please remember, this is considered a very establishment journalist. You know, nobody would question him normally. He, in fact, when you read his book and his articles, it's very clear that Gross tilts towards Israel. He's not at all anti-Israel. He's very sympathetic and largely frames things in an Israeli-centric sort of manner. Well, according to a magazine article that he wrote, a member of the Parashim, that was actually Horace Cowan, he tells that in a different article, went around in 1915 suggesting that the British government might benefit, as he put it, from a declaration in support of a Jewish state in Palestine. Now, those of us that have looked into this issue are very familiar with what's called the Balfour Declaration, in which Lord Balfour, who was the foreign minister of Britain, wrote a letter to Lord Rothschild, who was a major Zionist leader in Britain, saying basically His Majesty's government looks with favor on the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine, as long as this doesn't interfere with the, some of the rights of the non-Jewish population in Palestine. That's a rough paraphrase. Basically, it opened the door to, potentially it opened the door to Jewish colonization of Palestine to create a Jewish state in Palestine. That declaration was made in 1917. Now here we learn that in 1915, it was Horace Kallen who was planting that idea. It was then sent to some people in Britain and was taken up, especially by Chaim Weizmann, who was a very important Zionist leader in Britain at that time and later went on to become the first president of Israel. Now, some people might be thinking, wait, why would the British benefit from this, and why, in fact, would they have anything to do with Palestine and with creating a Jewish homeland in Palestine? In 1915 and still in 1917, Palestine was under the Ottoman Empire. The British Empire, huge as it was, did not contain Palestine. So what was this all about? Well, what was going on, as I'm sure many people remember, is this is the period of World War I, what at the time was called the Great War. So Britain was desperate to try to win that war, as was Germany. Germany was allied with the Ottoman Empire. So both sides were trying to get the United States into that war on their side. Britain was especially desperate at the first day of the Battle of the Somme, for example. The casualties were 50,000 British troops in one day of battle. So given that situation, they desperately wanted America to come in to that war on the side of Britain. Americans, however, were that apparently bad thing, isolationists. They did not want to join a foreign war that really made no sense whatsoever, to which they had no connection. They did not want to go over there, kill and be killed as part of this, quote, Great War. Woodrow Wilson, in fact, was elected to his second term of office with the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." So that was the viewpoint of the American population, very strongly. That was the viewpoint. What happened then is the British Zionists in Britain, especially Chaim Weizmann, went to the British government and said, well, they claimed, we can get the U.S. to enter the war on the side of Britain if you just give us a quid pro quo, that then when we win the war against Germany and the Ottoman Empire and you are in charge, you will facilitate the Zionist project of colonizing Palestine. So this was the quid pro quo that they offered to the British government and claimed, especially they said to Louis Brandeis, who was very close to Woodrow Wilson, that they had the power to bring the U.S. into World War I on the side of Britain. And that is the method by which they got the Balfour Declaration. Now again, this is, you know, to me was very startling information, shocking information. But it's in a number of books. It's well documented. It's in books by a number of historians who are very pro-Israel. And it's called, quote, the Gentleman's Agreement. That's, you know, that's what it's called. It was sort of this Gentleman's Agreement. Now, it's important to remember that while this was going on, the majority of Americans, including the majority of Jewish Americans, were not Zionists, did not want to join World War I, etc. This was a very manipulative tactic used by this political Zionist movement, of which Louis Brandeis was a leader, and there are many other significant leaders.
So, Allison, what we can suggest by your research as well as others is that the United States entered World War I under Woodrow Wilson's mandate based upon Zionists wanting to colonize the Palestinian territories, because there was no Israel then as we know Israel today. It was mainly Palestinians. And so they managed to get the United States into the war to help Great Britain win the war, and that's where the Balfour Declaration occurred, the agreement. And hence the tens of thousands, actually hundreds of thousands of Americans who died in the First World War did not die to save America. They died to give the Zionists, the political and ideological element of Zionism, a home. Is that correct or incorrect?
That could be correct. I think that's entirely possible and plausible. I don't know myself at this point whether Zionism was the factor that pushed the U.S. into that war that we, you know, for good reasons, did not want to join, where so many people died and others came back maimed in many, many, many different ways. I don't know if Zionism and Brandeis was the decisive factor.
But they were a factor.
It was one of several factors. Now, the British felt it was the decisive factor, and the Zionists themselves claimed they were the decisive factor. So that's entirely plausible.
So it's a plausible supposition.
Okay.
Let's take this a little further. How much does the original Zionist vision hold today among Israel's ruling elite, such as Netanyahu and his Likud group, and his closest cabinet members and Israeli supporters?
It's sadly very, very much there. It has some people, the party in power now, and Netanyahu, the people that support him, are really just astoundingly extremists. You know, they make statements against Palestinians that would be abhorrent to Americans across the political spectrum. Their statements at times are not just against Palestinians, and again, this is very little known. Often they make statements, categorical, very offensive statements against non-Jews in general. Now, those statements are not necessarily held by the majority of the population of Israel, but they are very prominent in the movement and in the portion of the population that endorses Netanyahu and that were very significant in getting Netanyahu elected. And they are represented at high levels of the cabinet that he has chosen, that is in charge of Israel right now.
Okay. That's a sad reality,
but that's very clear, and it's written about in the Israeli media and in some U.S. media as well. Not the mainstream media, but Jewish media such as the Forward and Jewish Telegraphic Agency, for example.
I'm going to ask you some questions now that we have the larger overview, if you could give us more succinct answers on these so we can get them all in, all right?
Sure.
Since one of the original Zionist motivations was to escape anti-Semitism in Europe and elsewhere, which was a very and is a legitimate motive, is there any evidence that Zionist organizations actually attempted to promulgate anti-Semitism in order to achieve their long-term goals?
Yes, that's a very short answer. Absolutely. They committed some actions in the Middle East and North Africa, for example, in which they would have, and again, this is well-documented, false flag operations in which people would be killed and think it was being done by the Muslim Brotherhood or by Muslim extremists, and in reality it was being done by Zionists, or once it became Israel, Israeli agents. This came out publicly in Egypt, for example, and was a scandal in Israel. So there were a number of actions undertaken that were intentionally done to increase anti-Semitism and therefore would cause people to go to Palestine, which was, you know, eventually became Israel. That was considered, that those were tactics that were used, because even at that time, even after World War II, when Zionism really took off, the majority of people still did not want to go to Palestine, to Israel, and were not going there. So Ben-Gurion and some of the other leaders realized they had to somehow trick or force people, more people, into going there and immigrating to Israel.
When and how did the Israeli lobby become so powerful and influential in American politics And what were the events that brought this about? Was this before Truman's vote in the United Nations to create a state of Israel, or was the Zionist agenda already gaining ground in U.S. politics before then? The popular view is that the United Nations created Israel and that the world, including the U.S., was in favor of this decision. Have you discovered evidence that this is not true?
Yes, I have. Both of those are myths that are unfounded when you look at the facts. The Israel lobby was already very significant by the early 1940s. It had had amount, hundreds of thousands of dollars that eventually it had access to, the kind of money that today would be the equivalent of about $1 billion. This was in the 1940s. They were using this to target every sector of U.S. society across the political spectrum and across the religious spectrum. The United Nations did not create Israel. In fact, it was only through bribes and threats that Zionists were able to push the General Assembly into voting a recommendation in which 55% of Palestine would be given to a Jewish state. That was only a recommendation. It had no force of law. It was, if it, it was supposed to go to the Security Council, which it never did. So it was, it really had no result in terms of legal, a legal result. What created Israel was a war of colonization, and really an Israeli historian has quite properly called it a war of ethnic cleansing. Ilan Pape, an excellent historian. This, the way Israel was created was through warfare, in which at least 750,000 people, a large proportion of the entire Palestinian population, were forced off their land through violence, through warfare, and through numerous well-documented massacres. That's what created Israel.
Could you give us your understanding, and I realize this is subjective, of why the entire U.S. Senate, without one dissension, including Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or the so-called progressives, all voted unanimously in support of Israel, and not a single person said, this is wrong. Look at what you've created and how people are living in an apartheid state, and this is nothing more than apartheid. Why will the media not discuss this or not look at this?
Again, we come to those simple two words, the Israel lobby. It's astounding. You know, some people think, oh, this can't be true. And I certainly did not expect it to be true when I started my research. But when you look at the dynamics of it, it's very simple. We know how politics works. We know that politicians, especially in the House of Representatives, every 2 years have to be reelected. That requires a great amount of money, and having the media on your side helps as well. Senate has to do it every 6 years. So getting reelected is at the top of everybody's mind in our representative government. What they all know, and anybody else can see when we really look into what's going on, is that if someone speaks out even mildly against what Israel's doing, if they even, talk about Palestinians in a sympathetic way, there is a high likelihood. This doesn't happen 100% of the time, but it's a very high likelihood that they will trigger an action in which a huge amount of money will be funneled to their opponent in the next election, and that opponent will have, with that kind of money, will have the best political campaign that money can buy. May not even talk about Israel-Palestine. They may talk about jobs or the environment or maybe agriculture, depending on the state, and then that opponent will win. And the opponent that had the integrity to try to talk about Israel-Palestine, even a little bit honestly, will have lost the election. Also, the media is extremely Israel-centric. I've studied that a great deal. That's not very much that's in my book to a degree, but it's more evident on my website, If Americans Knew. But the media also is extremely Israel-centric. So we have a pattern that has been occurring for many years in which candidates that oppose Israel will also get very negative media coverage. That's a double whammy. Our politicians, the way they get elected is by knowing how to avoid what will cause them to lose elections, both parties. That double whammy is so powerful, so significant, that it pretty much controls what our politicians will say and certainly how they will vote. There will be a few exceptions here and there, but very few and only here and there. That's what's going on.
Okay, we tend to have the belief that terrorism was developed and originated among Arabs and Muslim groups. But even Menachem Begin, when he was prime minister, bragged that it was the Zionists who brought terrorism to both the Middle East and the world. Would you give us a history lesson about early Zionist terrorist movements during the early days of Israel's founding and how this continues today against Palestinians and other enemies of the State of Israel?
I'd be glad to. As you said, he said that to an American journalist who was filming a TV interview. The journalist asked Prime Minister Menachem Begin, what does it feel like to have introduced terrorism to the Middle East? And Begin responded bragging, not just the Middle East, to the world. Well, he was being honest. That's just what happened, at least in terms of the Middle East. There were when Zionism began and there was this colonization of Palestine, eventually, not surprising, the indigenous people saw what was going on, and there started to be violence between the two groups. There were then, after a few decades, you know, by about the 1920s, 1930s, I believe the 20s, some Zionist groups, terrorist groups, were formed. That were the Irgun and the Stern Gang, are the short names for the longer Israeli names of these two groups. They were led by Menachem Begin, one was led by Yitzhak Shamir. These men both went on later to become prime ministers of Israel, and yet they began their careers as terrorist leaders. Now, again, you know, committing all sorts of violence, throwing bombs, killing innocent people, Palestinians of, you know, both Christian and Muslim, British as well. Sometimes Jews were killed in the various bombings that they did for the, you know, King David Hotel, for example. Really, just true terrorism. And what I discovered and have in my book that's less widely known is that there were front groups in the United States that were closely connected to these terror groups in Palestine that were funneling the money and weaponry. That this was going on, the Justice Department tried to clamp down on them, but failed to do that, as often goes on with anything related to Israel. But they were significant. One of them was led by a man who was named Hillel Cook. He was the agent for the Irgun. He went to the United States specifically as the Irgun agent, as their operative, and in the United States he went under the name of Peter Bergson, and his group was called, quote, the Bergson Boys. The Zionist terrorism that began at that time has continued. There were at least 33 massacres during its founding war that went from about 1947 to 49. 16 of the massacres occurred before a single Arab army joined that war. Then the terrorism continued. Sharon, who later on became prime minister, was prime minister not too many years ago, was the leader of a unit in the Israeli army that would go and bomb people's homes while they were still in them, just private civilian homes, family homes with people still in them. That was well known. He was connected to a number of other massacres. In recent years, Israel has, just in the last 5 or 6 years, has invaded Gaza 3 times with huge, huge numbers of civilians killed, huge numbers of children killed. The world occasionally tries to hold them accountable for this, you know, for this very public slaughter of human beings. And yet the United States, because of the Israel lobby, consistently works to shield Israel from any kind of consequences for those actions. And these invasions that we occasionally do get it on the news, so there are periods when Americans, to a degree, see what's going on. even though we're always told, well, the Palestinians initiated it, it was because of the rockets, is claimed. When in fact, the chronology shows it's the opposite. That wasn't the case at all. You know, that's been rebutted many times, but it gets repeated anyway. But in between these visible invasions are daily invasions in which Israeli troops go into the West Bank, most often, but also periodically into Gaza. They daily abduct people, beat people up, imprison them without any kind of even pretense of a trial or a judicial process. This is called administrative detention. What that means is they're not even charged with a crime. Now, an Israeli partisan here would say, oh, but they can only be held 6 months. Now, that to me is a long time. You know, you're not even charged with a crime, and you're held for 6 months. But the reality is that can and often is renewed indefinitely. So people in a number of cases are held for many years without even being charged with any sort of crime whatsoever. This is just the normal state of affairs for Palestinians in today's world and has been going on for decades.
Allison, earlier this year, Netanyahu and his Likud party won another term. For many around the world, it was a surprise. But worse, it was an indication that the people of Israel support an aggressive, violent regime not too dissimilar to the message Americans gave the rest of the world when Bush was reelected for a second term. But I witness that his win provided him with a mandate to terrorize Palestinians even further, and if given the opportunity to remove them all from their homelands. What is your assessment of the Netanyahu winning another term, and do you see evidence that this term might be even more dictatorial than the previous one?
Definitely. There's a great deal of evidence that he has stacked his cabinet, has extremists in it. He has made it clear he will ignore the rest of the world. He panders to the extreme worst parts of the Israeli population, and there are, as I'm sure you and your listeners know, there are very good parts calling for peace, calling for compromise, calling for justice. He has no interest whatsoever in those portions of the Israeli public, and unfortunately, the mandate he received in the election made it clear that he could and will continue to push extreme policies. He will continue to confiscate even more Palestinian land for what is euphemistically called settlements. You know, this is just stealing people's land, throwing them off it, and creating what in the Israeli parlance are Jewish-only
enclaves.
Cities that will be there for eternity. That's the way they talk about this type of thing.
I'd like
and,
for you
and
to,
even the U.S. government says that this is, you know, not helpful for peace.
I would like for you to focus upon the current U.S.-Israeli relations, and we know that Hillary Clinton, who continues to hold the Democratic lead in the primaries, is strong as an ally of Israel and its lobby. The public release of an email detailing her correspondence with the Jewish lobbyist in the context of growing opposition towards Israel for war crimes and efforts to get universities and institutions to divest any financial interest they hold in Israel clearly shows where her stance is in support of Israel. And also, Hillary's stint as Secretary of State is fraught with neocon hawkish actions, including against Libya, Honduras. I would include Ukraine, since she was the supporter of Victoria Nuland to get appointed to the State Department. But I want to first look at her husband's Israeli policy, since this is where the historical precedent lies and provides some indication of what we might expect from a Hillary president, because anyone who is naive enough to assume that Bill Clinton is merely window dressing, then I have only this statement: there is no cure for stupid. So first, how would you characterize Bill Clinton's position on Israel and peace efforts in the Middle East? And then how would you characterize Hillary's term in the State Department?
Both certainly dreadful patterns for anybody that wants any kind of peace in the Middle East or any kind of independent United States. They've both been very close to Israel partisans. That's often who has funded them. There have been some articles talking about, you know, the close connections of Israel partisans to their campaigns, to the money by which they get elected. They have certainly Hillary Clinton, you know, was basically making it clear to Chaim Saban, who's an Israeli citizen, a dual citizen of the United States, who has said, you know, what matters to him is Israel. She's made it very clear that she will do everything and anything that he wants, and then that will get his money. This has been going on for a long time. The Republican Party, too, of course, is doing the same thing. There's Sheldon Adelson, who's another billionaire. Chaim Saban is a multi-billionaire. He's very powerful. Sheldon Adelson even has more billions of dollars, and he's made it very clear that he will fund the Republicans. At times, they work together. These are, you know, supposedly political antagonists, and to a degree they are. Chaim Saban is a Democrat, and Sheldon Adelson is a Republican. They may disagree on other aspects, but on Israel they are unified. So they have some joint projects that they work on together. And again, this is very public. It's just our mainstream media don't usually tell us about these things. Just a little bit about Saban that I think people will find interesting is that he has funded a number of think tanks. He's very powerful in the media. He has, is part of these super PACs that raise money on behalf of Israel. He has said that there are three ways to be influential in American politics. Quote, that you make donations to political parties, establish think tanks, and control media outlets. This is what he has worked to do. He funds the American Israel Education Foundation, which was basically a branch of AIPAC. In fact, it's located in the same building. That's just one entity of many, but that particular entity takes members of Congress on all expense-paid tours of Israel, where they receive huge doses of pro-Israel propaganda. You know, all of our congresspeople are taken over on these junkets. And again, the media almost never mentions it. A few years ago, a few hundred, I believe it was, were taken. This is a significant activity. And yet again, the media weren't talking. It was in the Israeli media, but it wasn't in the American media. So often, if you want to know about what's happening to our own money, what our own politicians are doing, about some legislation that gets slipped through, the place to learn about it is not the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or PBS. It's go to the Israeli media. That's where you can learn about it. And that's how this continues to go on. This is how somebody like Hillary Clinton can be a front runner in a party where most members of the party would not be for the kinds of actions that Israel is undertaking against Palestinians. Most members of the Democratic Party are not for war. They're not for oppressing indigenous peoples. And yet here we have the front runner of the Democratic Party, somebody who will enable and probably enlarge those activities if she's elected.
Allison, original fascism was when government took control of private corporations. And today in the United States, private corporations and banks have taken over the U.S. government. Recently, a joint study out of Princeton and Northwestern universities concluded the U.S. is no longer a democracy, but an oligarchy. If so, this may indicate that much of our pro-Israeli policies are also those of our multinational financial firms and corporations. Do you have any information that you can share about U.S. corporate and banking interests in Israel and the Zionist agenda that may explain our government's fanatical pro-Israel stance?
Well, there's certainly an intermingling, especially with banking. Jack Lew, who is the U.S. Treasurer, is an Israeli citizen. He's very connected to Israel. The latest, I believe, head of the Federal Reserve Bank, if I'm remembering. Let me think. No, that's a different person. Anyway, there's someone who is very high up in the Bank of Israel, who is now high up in the U.S. political and economic process. So there's quite a bit of intermingling that is part of the big picture that's important to be aware of. However, I also think that what's going on is that when you look at the number of billionaires, and remember, you know, if anybody knows, a billionaire has a huge power because money brings power. If you decide to wield it, power, it, you know, that's where it is. So what you find when you look at billionaires in the United States is that the ones that are pro-Israel tend to use their money in a pro-Israel way, a way that will facilitate getting even more American tax money to Israel, and that will buy politicians, that will influence media, that will be significant in Hollywood, for example. You know, billionaires that are pro-Israel very, very often use their money in a way to benefit Israel. Billionaires that don't have a view on Israel-Palestine, which is the other half, approximately, of American billionaires, don't really wield their money on this particular issue. They, of course, wield it on other political issues to influence and many of us feel manipulate and distort the political processes in a very disagreeable and immoral way in many cases. But they're not countering the ones that the billionaires that are pro-Israel. So this is part of why this dynamic goes on. You know, okay. You have very powerful people, but those in favor of Israel are the ones that are using their money that way, and the others really couldn't care less and don't work to counter it.
Allison, I have one final question for you. It'll have to be a rather short answer. I know you've been criticized vehemently by the Israeli Jewish community as anti-Semitic. I've had guests who have been very critical of Israel periodically, such as Rabbi Michael Lerner, Uri Avnery, former IDF officer whistleblowers on Israeli military crimes against Palestinians, Francis Boyle, and others. I've also seen people who would listen to a normal program of mine, but the moment Israel's brought up, they turn it off. So I'd like for you to look at the term anti-Semitic and how it's taken a life of its own, almost completely out of any historical and valid context, and is used repeatedly against anyone who raises any objections to Israel political decisions and actions. And the critics of Israel are not targeting religion. They're criticizing political decisions and actions by a government that has committed criminal acts. And I would like you to address this in your final comments.
That's exactly what's going on. This is, as even an Israeli politician very honestly said publicly, and she was stating it because she opposed it, but she said this is a trick that we use, that Israel uses. Whenever anybody starts to say anything critical of Israel or presents the many facts about Israel that show it in a negative light, immediately they're called anti-Semitic. That's meant to discredit the person, to undermine their effectiveness, and to try to prevent that information and that perspective from getting to the American public. Many of us have factual information. It's important for people to learn. Everybody that I work with directly clearly has a life history of opposing bigotry, of opposing racism, of believing that we can and all should live together and share our planet without killing one another. That's one of the things that motivates us. So this is just a very sad and offensive tactic that's being used, and truthfully, it's crying wolf too often. It's beginning to have, the term anti-Semitism is beginning to have no meaning whatsoever because of the way it's being misused and abused.
Allison Weir, I want to thank you for being on. By the way, her name is spelled W-E-I-R. She's a journalist, civil rights and peace activist, and the president of the Council for the National Interest. She is also the founder of the organization If Americans Knew, which analyzes and reports on U.S. media coverage of Israel-Palestine. She has presented briefings before Congress on the U.S. and the Israeli-Palestinian crisis, and she's lectured at Harvard, Columbia, Stanford, Yale, Berkeley, and to academies and institutions around the world, received many awards, and is the author of Against Our Better Judgment, How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel. Her website is ifamericansknew.org. Thank you very much, Allison, for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Gary Knoll. You've been listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour.